Chapter 13. Now I must go get back to Edmund. When he had been made to walk far further than he had ever known that anybody could walk, the witch at last halted in a dark valley all overshadowed with fir trees and yew trees. Edmund simply sank down and lay on his face, doing nothing at all and not even caring what was going to happen next, provided they would let him lie still. He was too tired even to notice how hungry and thirsty he was. The witch and the dwarf were talking close beside him in low tones. "No," said the dwarf, "it is of no use now, O Queen. They must have reached the stone table by now." "Perhaps the wolf will smell us out and bring us news," the witch said.
"It cannot be good news if he does," said the dwarf.
"Four thrones and Cara Paravel," said the witch. "How if only three are filled?"
"That would not fill the prophecy."
"What difference would that make now that he is here?" said the dwarf. He did not dare even now to mention the name of Aslan to his mistress.
"He may not stay long, and then we would fall upon the three at care."
"Yet it might be better," said the dwarf, "to keep this one," here he kicked Edmund, "for bargaining with."
"Yes, and have him rescued," said the witch scornfully.
"Then," said the dwarf, "we had better do what we have to do at once."
"I would like to have it done at the stone table itself," said the witch.
"That is the proper place. That is where it has always been done before."
"It will be a long time now before the stone table can again be put to its proper use," said the dwarf.
"True," said the witch. "And then, well, I will begin." At that moment, with a rush and a snarl, a wolf rushed up to them.
"I have seen them. They are all at the stone table, with him. They have killed my captain, Margrim. I was hidden in the thicket, and I saw it all. One of the sons of Adam killed him. Fly, fly!"
"No," said the witch. "There need be no flying. Go quickly. Summon all of our people to meet me here as speedily as they can. Call out the giants and the werewolves and the spirits of those trees who are on our side. Call the ghouls and the boggles and the ogres and the minotaurs. Call the cruels, the hags, the specters, and the people of the toadstools. We will fight. What, have I not still my wand? Will not their ranks turn into stone even as they come on? Be off quickly. I have a little thing to finish here while you are away."
The great brute bowed his head, turned, and galloped away.
"Now," she said, "we have no table. Let me see. We had better put it against the trunk of a tree." Edmund found himself being roughly forced to his feet. Then the dwarf set him with his back against the tree and bound him fast. He saw the witch take off her outer mantle. Her arms were bare underneath and it and terribly white. Because they were so very white, he could see them, but he could not see much else. It was so dark in this valley under the dark tree.
"Prepare the victim," said the witch, and the dwarf undid Edmund's collar and folded back his shirt at the neck.
Then he took Edmund's hair and pulled his head back so that he had to raise his chin. After that, Edmund heard a strange noise, whiz, whiz, whiz. For a moment, he couldn't think of what it was. Then he realized it was the sound of a knife being sharpened. At that very moment, he heard loud shouts from every direction, a drumming of hooves and a beating of wings, a scream from the witch, confusion all around him. And then he found that he was being untied. Strong arms were around him, and he heard big, kind voices saying things like, "Let him lie down, give him some wine, drink this, steady now, you'll be all right in a minute." Then he heard the voices of people who were not talking to him, but to one another. And they were saying things like, "Who's got the witch? I thought you had her. I didn't see her after I knocked the knife out of her hand. I was after the dwarf. Do you mean to say that she's escaped? A chap can't mind everything at once. What's that? Oh, sorry, that's only an old stump." But just at this point, Edmund went off in a dead faint. Presently, the centaurs and unicorns and deer and birds, who were, of course, the rescue party which Aslan had sent in the last chapter, all set off to go back to the stone table, carrying Edmund with them. But if they had seen what had happened in the valley after they had gone, I think they might have been surprised. It was perfectly still, and presently the moon grew bright. If you had been there, you would have seen the moonlight shining on an old tree stump and a fair-sized boulder. But if you had gone on looking, you would have gradually begun to think that there was something odd about both the stump and the boulder. And next, you would have thought that the stump did look really remarkably like a fat man crouching on the ground. And if you had watched long enough, you would have seen the stump walk across to the boulder, and the boulder sit up and begin talking to the stump. For in reality, the stump and the boulder were simply the witch and the dwarf. For it was part of her magic that she could make things look like what they aren't. And she had the presence of mind to do so at that very moment when the knife was knocked out of her hand, and she kept hold of her wand so that it had been kept safe, too. When the other children woke up the next morning, they had been sleeping on piles of cushions in the pavilion. The first thing they had heard from Mrs. Beaver was that their brother had been rescued and brought into camp late last night, and was at that moment with Aslan. As soon as they had breakfasted, they all went out, and there they saw Aslan and Edmund walking together in the dewy grass, apart from the rest of the court. There's no need to tell you, and no one ever heard what Aslan was saying, but it was a conversation which Edmund never forgot, and the others drew nearer Aslan. As the others drew nearer, Aslan turned to meet them, bringing Edmund with him. "Here is your brother," he said, "and there is no need to talk to him about what has passed." Edmund shook hands with each of the others and said to each of them in turn, "I'm sorry." And everyone said, "That's all right." And then everyone wanted very hard to say something which would make it quite clear that they were all friends with him again. Something ordinary and natural. And, of course, no one could think of anything in the world to say. But before they had time to feel really awkward, one of the leopards approached Aslan and said, "Sire, there is a messenger from the enemy who craves an audience." "Well, let him approach," said Aslan. The leopard went away and soon returned, leading the witch's dwarf. "What is your message, son of Earth?" Aslan asked. "The Queen of Narnia and Empress of the Lone Islands desires a safe conduct to come and speak with you," said the dwarf, "on a matter which is as much to your advantage as to hers." "Queen of Narnia, indeed," said Mr. Beaver, all the cheek. "Peace, Beaver," said Aslan. "All names will soon be restored to their proper owners. In the meantime, we will not dispute about them. Tell your mistress, son of Earth, that I grant her safe conduct on condition that she leaves her wand behind her at that great oak." This was agreed to, and two leopards went back with the dwarf to see that the conditions were properly carried out. "But supposing she turns the two leopards into stone," whispered Lucy to Peter. I think the same idea had occurred to the leopards themselves. At any rate, as they walked off, their fur was all standing up on their backs and their tails were bristling, like a cat's when it sees a strange dog. "It'll be all right," Peter whispered in reply. "He wouldn't send them if they weren't." A few minutes later, the witch herself walked back on to the top of the hill and came straight across and stood before Aslan. The three children, who had not seen her before, felt shudders running down their backs at the sight of her face, and there were low growls among all of the animals present. Though it was bright sunshine, everyone felt suddenly cold. The only two people present who seemed to be quite at their ease were Aslan and the witch herself. It was the oddest thing to see those two faces, the golden face and the dead white face, so close together. Not that the witch looked Aslan exactly in the eyes. Mrs. Beaver particularly noticed that part. "You have a traitor there, Aslan," said the witch. Of course, everyone present knew that she meant Edmund. But Edmund had got past thinking about himself after all he'd been through and after the talk he'd had that morning. He just went on looking at Aslan. It didn't seem to matter what the witch said. "Well," said Aslan, "his defense was not against you." "Have you forgotten the deep magic?" asked the witch. "Let us say that I have forgotten it," he said gravely. tell us of the deep magic. Tell you, said the witch, her voice growing suddenly shriller. Tell you what is written on the very stone table which stands beside us? Tell you what is written in letters deep as a spear's long in the firestones on the secret hill? Tell you what is engraved on the scepter of the emperor beyond the sea? You at least know the magic which the emperor put into Narnia at the very beginning. You know that every traitor belongs to me as my lawful prey, and that for every treachery I have a right to a kill. Oh, said Mr. Beaver, so that's how you came to imagine yourself a queen, because you were the emperor's hangman, I see. Peace, Beaver, said Aslan, with a very slow growl. And so, continued the witch, that human creature is mine. His life is forfeit to me. His blood is my property. Come and take it, then, said the bull with the man's head in a great bellowing voice. Fool, said the witch, with a savage smile that was almost a snarl. Do you really think your master can rob me of my rights by mere force? He knows the deep magic better than that. He knows that unless I have blood, as the law says, all Narnia will be overturned and perish in fire and water. It is very true, said Aslan. I do not deny it. Oh, Aslan, whispered Susan in the lion's ear. Can't we? I mean, you won't, will you? Can't we do something about the deep magic? Isn't there something that you can work against it? Work against the Emperor's magic? Aslan said, turning to her with something like a frown on his face. Nobody ever made that suggestion to him again. Edmund was on the other side of Aslan, looking all the time at Aslan's face. He felt a choking feeling and wondered if he ought to say something. But a moment later, he felt that he was not expected to do anything except to wait and do nothing and to do exactly what he was told to do. Fall back, all of you, said Aslan, and I will talk with the witch alone. They all obeyed. It was a terrible time, this, waiting and wondering while the lion and the witch talked earnestly together in low voices. Lucy said, Oh, Edmund, and began to cry. Peter stood with his back to the others, looking out at the distant sea. The beavers stood holding each other's paws with their heads bowed. The centaur stamped uneasily with their hooves, but everyone became perfectly still in the end, so that you notice even small sounds like a bumblebee flying past, or the birds in the forest down below them, or the wind rustling in the leaves. And still the talk between Aslan and the White Witch went on. At last he heard Aslan's voice. You can all come back, he said. I have settled the matter. She has renounced the claim on your brother's blood. And all over the hill there was a noise as if everyone had been holding their breaths and had now begun breathing again, and then a murmur of talking. The witch was just turning away with a look of fierce joy on her face when she stopped and said, But how do I know this promise will be kept? Aslan roared, half rising from his throne, and his great mouth opened wider and wider, and the roar grew louder and louder. And the witch, after staring for a moment with her lips wide apart, picked up her skirts and fairly ran for her life. Chapter 14. As soon as the witch had gone, Aslan said, We must move from this place at once. It will be wanted for other purposes. We shall encamp tonight at the fords of Barona. Of course, everyone was dying to ask him how he had arranged matters with the witch, but his face was stern and everyone's ears were still ringing with the sound of his roar, so no one dared. After a meal, which was taken in the open air on the hilltop, for the sun had got strong by now and had dried the grass. They were busy for a while taking the pavilion down and packing everything up. Before 2 o'clock they were on the march and set off in a northeasterly direction, walking at an easy pace, for they had not far to go. During the first part of the journey, Aslan explained to Peter his plan of campaign. As soon as she has finished her business in these parts, he said, The witch and her crew will almost certainly fall back to her house and prepare for a siege. You may or may not be able to cut her off and prevent her from reaching it. He then went on to outline 2 plans of battle, one for fighting the witch and her people in the woods, and another for assaulting her castle. All this time, he was advising Peter on how to conduct operations, saying things like, you must put your centaurs in such and such a place, or you should post scouts to see that she doesn't do so and so, till at last Peter said, but you will be there yourself, Aslan. I can give you no promise of that, he said, and he continued giving Peter his instructions. For the last part of the journey, it was Susan and Lucy who saw most of him. He didn't talk much and seemed to them to be really sad. It was still afternoon when they came down to a place where the river valley had widened out and the river was broad and shallow. This was the fords of Verona, and Aslan had given orders to halt on this side of the water. Peter said, wouldn't it be better to camp on the far side for fear she might try a night attack or anything? Aslan, who seemed to be thinking about something else, roused himself with a shake of his magnificent mane and said, what's that? Peter then repeated what he had said. No, said Aslan in a dull voice, as if it didn't matter. No, she will not make an attack tonight. And then he sighed deeply. But presently he added, all the same, it was well thought of. That is how a soldier ought to think, but it doesn't really matter. So they proceeded to pitch their tents in the camp. Aslan's mood affected everyone that evening. Peter was feeling uncomfortable too at the idea of fighting the battle on his own. The news that Aslan might not be there had come as a great shock to him. Supper that evening was a quiet meal. Everyone felt how different it had been last night or even that morning. It was as if the good times having just begun were already drawing to their end. Now this feeling affected Susan so much that she couldn't go to sleep when she went to bed. After she had lain counting sheep and turning over and over, she heard Lucy give a sigh and turn over just beside her in the darkness. Can't you sleep either? She asked. No, said Lucy. I thought you were asleep. I say, Susan. What? I just had the most horrible feeling, as if something were hanging over us. Have you? Because, as a matter of fact, so have I. Something about Aslan's, Lucy said. Either something dreadful is going to happen to him, or something dreadful that he's going to do. There's been something wrong with him all afternoon, Susan added. Lucy, what was that he said about not being with us at the battle? You don't think he could be stealing away and leaving us tonight, do you? Where is he now? Lucy asked. Is he here in the pavilion? I don't think so. Susan, let's go outside and have a look around. We might see him. All right, let's, said Susan. We might just as well be doing that as lying awake here. Very quietly, the two girls groped their way among the other sleepers and crept out of the tent. The moonlight was bright and everything was quiet, still except for the noise of the river chattering and over the stones. Then Susan completely caught Lucy's arm and said, look! On the far side of the camping ground, just where the trees began, they saw the lions slowly walking away from them into the wood. Without a word, they both followed him. He led them up the steep slope out of the river valley, and then slightly to the right, apparently by this very same route that they had used that afternoon, and coming from the hill, the stone table. On and on he led them, into the dark shadows, and out into the pale moonlight, getting their feet wet with the heavy dew. He looked somehow different from the Aslan they knew. His tail and his head hung low, and he walked slowly, as if he were very, very tired. Then, when they were crossing a wide open place where there were no shadows for them to hide in, he stopped and looked around. It was no good trying to run away, so they came toward him. When they were closer, he said, oh, children, children, why are you following me? We couldn't sleep, Lucy said, and then felt sure that she need say no more and that Aslan knew all that they had been thinking. Please, may we come with you, wherever you're going? Susan asked. Well, said Aslan, and seemed to be thinking. He then said, I should be glad of company tonight. Yes, you may come, if you will promise to stop when I tell you, and after that leave me to go on alone. Oh, thank you, we will, the two girls said. Forward they went again, and one of the girls walked on each side of the lion. But how slowly he walked. His great royal head dropped so his nose nearly touched the grass. Presently he stumbled and gave a low moan. "Aslan, dear Aslan," said Lucy, "what's wrong? Can't you tell us? Are you ill, dear Aslan?" asked Susan. "No," he replied. "I'm sad and lonely. Lay your hands on my mane so I can feel that you are there, and let us walk like that." And so the girls did what they had never even dared to do without his permission, but what they had longed to do ever since they first saw him. They buried their cold hands into the beautiful sea of fur and stroked it, and so doing, walked with him. Presently they saw that they were going with him up the slope of the hill on which the stone table stood. They went up on the side where the trees came furthest up, and when they got to the last tree, it was the one that had some branches about it, Aslan stopped and said, "Oh, children, children, here you must stop. Whatever happens, do not let yourselves be seen. Farewell." Both girls cried bitterly, they hardly knew why, and clung to the lion and kissed his mane and his nose and his paws and his great sad eyes. Then he turned from them and walked out into the top of the hill. Lucy and Susan then, crouching in the bushes, looked after him, and this is what they saw. A great crowd of people were standing all around the stone table, and though the moon was shining, many of them carried torches which burned with evil-looking red flames and black smoke. And such people! Ogres with monstrous teeth, wolves, bull-headed men, spirits of evil trees and poisonous plants, and other creatures whom I won't describe, because if I did, the grown-ups would probably not let you read this book. Cruels and hags and incubuses, wraiths, horrors, efreets, spirits, orcanics, hoozes, and ettins. In fact, here were all those who were on the witch's side, and whom the wolf had summoned at her command. Right in the middle, standing by the table, was the witch herself. A howl and a gobbler of dismay went up from the creatures, when they first saw the great lion pacing towards them, and for a moment even the witch herself seemed to be struck with fear. Then she recovered and gave a wild, fierce laugh. "The fool!" she cried. "The fool has come! Bind him fast!" Lucy and Susan held their breaths, waiting for Aslan's roar and his spring upon his enemies. But those never came. Four hags, grinning and leering, yet also at first hanging back and half afraid of what they had to do, had approached him. "Bind him, I say!" the White Witch repeated. The hags made a dart at him and shrieked with triumph when they found that he made no resistance at all. The others, the evil dwarves and the apes, rushed in to help them. Between them, they helped roll the lion over on his back and tied all four paws together, shouting and cheering as if they had done something brave, though had the lion chosen, one of those paws could have been the death of them all. But he made no noise, even when the enemy, straining and tugging, pulling the cord so tight that they cut into his flesh. Then they began to drag him towards the stone table. "Stop," said the witch. "Let him first be shaved." Another roar of mean laughter went up from her followers as an ogre with a pair of shears came forward and squatted down by Aslan's head. Snip, snip, snip with the shears, and masses of curling gold began to fall on the ground. Then the ogre stood back, and the children, watching from their hiding place, could see the face of Aslan looking all small and different without his mane. The enemies also saw the difference. "Why, he's only a great cat, after all," one cried out. "Is that what we were afraid of?" another said. And they surged around Aslan, jeering at him, saying things like, "Puss, puss, poor pussy," and "How many mice have you caught today, cat?" and "Would you like a saucer of milk, possum?" "Oh, how can they?" said Lucy, tears streaming down her cheeks. "The brutes! The brutes!" For now that the first shock was over, the shorn face of Aslan looked to her braver and more beautiful and more patient than ever. "Muzzle him," said the witch. And even now, as they worked about his face, putting on that muzzle, one bite from his jaws could have cost two or three of them their hands. But he never moved, and this seemed to enrage all the rabble. Everyone was at him now. Those who had been afraid to come near him, even after he was bound, began to fight and find the courage. And for a few minutes, the two girls could not even see him. So thickly was he surrounded by the whole crowd of creatures kicking him, hitting him, spitting on him, jeering at him. At last, the rabble had had enough of this. They began to draw the bound, muzzled lion to the stone table, some pulling, some pushing. He was so huge that even when they got him there, it took all their efforts to hoist him up the surface of it. Then there was even more trying and tying and tightening of the cords. The cowards, Susan sobbed. Are they still afraid of him, even now? When once Aslan had been tied, and tied so that he was really a mass of cords, on the flat stone, a hush fell on the crowd. Four hags, holding four torches, stood at the corners of the table. The witch bared her arms as she had bared them the previous night when it had been Edmund instead of Aslan. Then she began to whet her knife. It looked to the children, when the gleam of the torchlight fell on it, as if the knife were made of stone, not of steel, and it was of a strange and evil shape. At last she drew near. She stood by Aslan's head. Her face was working and twitching with passion, but his look up at the sky, still quiet, neither angry nor afraid, but a little sad. Then, just before she gave the blow, she stopped, stooped down, and said in a quivering voice, "And now, who has won? Fool, do you think that by all this, you would save the human traitor? Now I will kill you instead of him as our pact was, and so the deep magic will be appeased. But when you are dead, what will prevent me from killing him as well? And who will take him out of my hand then? Understand that you have given me Narnia forever. You have lost your own life, and you have not saved his. In that knowledge, despair and die." The children did not see the actual movement of the killing. They couldn't bear to look and had covered their eyes by then.